This is Lecture 4 in the series Essentials of Capitalism. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first thing I want to discuss this morning is the institution of inheritance. As in the case of the broader institution of private property as such, the institution of inheritance is perceived as being of benefit only to the owners of the property involved. In this case, those who are fortunate enough to be heirs, and not as being of benefit to anyone else. Indeed, the interests of the non-heirs are usually perceived as lying with the confiscation and redistribution of inheritances, and thus with a more or less complete abolition of the institution. Despite the popularity of this view, the fact is that if inherited wealth remains invested, and it almost always does when it is received in a large amount, its existence is to the benefit of everyone. In order to benefit from its existence, one need not be an heir. One need merely be a buyer of the products it helps to produce, and whose supply is increased because of it. One need merely be a wage earner whose labor is in additional demand, and whose wages are higher because of it. The institution of inheritance powerfully promotes the accumulation of capital. It provides a motive to people to maintain their capital, and even to go on accumulating additional capital as long as they live, for the sake of their heirs. Its effect is that substantially more capital exists than would otherwise be the case without it. And everyone in a division of labor society benefits from the existence of this additional capital, whether he himself is an heir or not. As I say, he benefits both in his capacity as a buyer of products and as a wage earner. For as I have already explained, the additional capital accumulation, by increasing the relative production of capital goods, raises and goes on raising the productivity of labor, and thus the supply of goods available for all. And at the same time, it increases the share of total consumption that is enjoyed by wage earners in comparison with non-wage earners. Rational self-interest dictates that everyone, non-heirs as well as heirs, uphold the institution of inheritance. From the point of view of the non-heirs, the rationale is that it enables their employers to pay them more and their suppliers to supply them with more, and indeed to supply them progressively better, at prices that are lower and lower relative to the wages they earn. These are the effects of greater capital accumulation. And the institution of inheritance promotes capital accumulation. However startling it may seem, the simple fact is that in a division of labor society, one benefits from the property of others, when those others are one's employers or suppliers, because the effect of their property is a greater means of buying what one sells and of producing what one buys. The institution of inheritance enhances these sources of gain. Indeed, I have slightly understated the case for inheritance from the point of view of the non-heirs. While it is true that most large inheritances do remain invested, the institution promotes capital accumulation even in the cases in which the heirs consume some or all of what they receive, as an elderly widow or minor child must often do, or as some heirs simply choose to do in order to have a fling. Because even in these cases, the capital is first accumulated, and because estates are constantly being built to be left to heirs, there is permanently more capital, even insofar as there are these cases in which all or most of an inheritance is consumed by the heirs. There are some points I'd like to make in connection with the loss of inheritances by heirs. I don't mean now a loss through consumption of the inheritance, but through its unwise investment. It is first of all necessary to realize that inherited wealth can easily be lost in this way. In a division of labor society, wealth is not only invested, but must constantly be reinvested under ever-changing conditions. Materials and most labor services are fully used up in the production of one batch of products and must be replaced immediately thereafter if production is to continue. Machinery and factory buildings, while lasting much longer, are also constantly in process of wearing out. They too must be periodically replaced. On the other hand, as time goes on, new products and new methods of production are introduced, and all those other dynamic changes occur that I described in Lecture 2 in connection with the necessity of economic competition. These changes make it impossible for heirs to continue with the routine established by the parent or grandparent who built their fortune. They must constantly reacquire their wealth through their own successful investments, investments which must win the approbation of the buyers of the products concerned under the freedom of competition. To the extent the heirs lack the ability to make the right investment decisions, but nonetheless attempt actively to manage their funds themselves, they risk the loss of their entire fortunes. If they recognize their lack of business ability, or if it has been recognized for them by the bequestors of their wealth, they must be content with a sharply reduced rate of return on their capital, which is the necessary accompaniment of making investments recognized as having a high degree of safety of principle. And from that low rate of return must usually be deducted management or trustees' fees. The effect of these facts is that unless one or more of the heirs possesses extraordinary ability, the relative significance of any given fortune in the economic system tends steadily to diminish as time goes on. For even if the heirs do not lose it outright through poor investments, and even if they are content to live within the income afforded by the low rate of return they earn on their capital, their fortune is unable to grow in pace with the new capital being accumulated by more talented investors earning higher rates of return, and therefore able to save and accumulate capital more rapidly. Moreover, the significance of any given fortune is further diminished by a tendency toward its constant subdivision among a growing number of descendants as one generation succeeds another. In just this way, the wealth of the present-day Astors and Vanderbilts, once among the greatest fortunes in the country, is now not nearly so large in relation to the rest of the economic system, and that of any given individual Astor or Vanderbilt is no greater than what tens of thousands of individuals have accumulated purely by their own efforts, all within the present generation. Even the much more recent and initially much greater fortunes of the Rockefellers, Fords, and Mellons show the same tendencies toward decline in their relative significance and toward continuous subdivision. On the basis of this discussion, and of our previous discussions concerning saving and capital accumulation and private property, it is possible to reach an intelligent appraisal of the effects of the inheritance and income taxes. The inheritance tax, especially on large inheritances, where it is often confiscatory, is practically a pure tax on capital. To the extent it exists and is actually carried out, that is, to the extent the so-called loopholes are closed so that the tax cannot be avoided, the long-run effect is to reduce the accumulation of capital by reducing the building of estates in the first place. It is pointless for people to accumulate fortunes intended to be bequeathed to heirs, which upon death the government confiscates and prevents from reaching the heirs. The effect of confiscatory inheritance taxes is to cause the builders of estates to consume their incomes more heavily and not to bother earning part of the incomes they might otherwise be capable of earning at any given time. For their motivation both to save and to earn the income out of which saving can occur is reduced. Inheritance taxes which are not so high as to prevent heirs from substantially benefiting from the accumulation of estates do not deprive the builders of estates of this motive to earn and save. By the same token, they do not achieve the egalitarian objectives of most supporters of the inheritance tax. Nevertheless, even these more modest inheritance taxes reduce capital accumulation to the extent that they are paid with funds that otherwise would have remained invested. Any inheritance tax whatever reduces capital to the extent that it is paid with funds that otherwise would have remained invested. The specific way that such disinvestment occurs is that the heirs or the executors of an estate find it necessary to sell part of the estate to pay the taxes. This siphons funds from the buyers of these portions of the estates into the government's treasury. If the heirs had not had to sell, the buyers of these portions of the estates would have had to use their funds for the purchase of other capital assets, which would have existed alongside and in addition to the inherited wealth of the heirs. Instead, as matters stand, the funds of the buyers are diverted from the purchase of such additional capital assets into the purchase of part of the heirs' existing capital assets, and from there to the government's treasury and its expenditures. The result is less accumulated capital. This remains the result, I must point out, even if the government were to use the proceeds of the inheritance tax exclusively for such alleged capital purposes as the building of roads, bridges, canals, and tunnels, the making of river and harbor improvements, and the like. For even if government expenditures for such purposes really did represent capital formation, which they do not, they would be at the expense of that much less private capital formation, so long as they were financed by the inheritance tax. The fact is, however, that most government spending is avowedly for purposes of consumption, such as welfare payments and expenditures for military preparations. And what is for alleged capital purposes is almost always carried out with enormous waste and inefficiency in comparison with what private enterprise would achieve if it were responsible for the same undertaking. Thus, when they do the least damage conceivable, inheritance taxes represent a diversion of capital into financing activities that are necessary or useful to a country's ability to produce, but which are carried on inefficiently under government ownership. Such activities should not be carried on by the government in the first place. If they are carried on by the government, they should not be financed by an inheritance tax or by any other tax that substantially reduces capital accumulation. Finally, the use of the inheritance tax to finance such expenditures as welfare payments and outlays for defense, which is what, for the most part, it is actually used for, is an unmitigated assault on the foundations of a country's standard of living. In every case, the inheritance tax reduces the demand for labor that business firms are able to make, and thus either the wage rates or volume of employment that they are able to offer. Simultaneously, it reduces the demand for capital goods, and thus the economic system's degree of concentration on their production, and consequently, the ability of the economic system to raise the productivity of labor and to progress. It always represents a diversion of funds from capital to consumption, and is thus a force working against both economic progress and the share of total consumption in the economic system that goes to the employees of business firms, whose wages are paid out of capital. The progressive personal income tax, the corporate income tax, and the capital gains tax all operate in essentially the same way as the inheritance tax. They are all paid with funds that otherwise would have been saved and invested. All of them reduce the demand for labor by business firms in comparison with what it would otherwise have been, and thus either the wage rates or the volume of employment that business firms can offer, for they deprive business firms of the funds with which to pay labor. By the same token, they deprive business firms of the funds with which to buy capital goods. This, together with the greater spending for consumers' goods emanating from the government, causes the production of capital goods to drop relative to the production of consumers' goods. And this, in turn, threatens not only the economic system's ability to progress, but even its ability to produce sufficient capital goods to replace those that are used up in production, that is, to remain stationary. The Social Security system also operates in a similar way. People regard their Social Security taxes as a form of saving, and thus save less in other forms. Yet the government diverts the proceeds of the Social Security taxes into the financing of its current expenditures, with the result that no savings are actually accumulated by the system. Thus, the net effect of Social Security is to reduce saving and investment and capital accumulation. The existence of inflation, of an increase in the quantity of money caused by the government, or equivalently, an increase in the quantity of money more rapid than the increase in gold and silver, greatly intensifies the destructive effects of these taxes. For inflation creates additional profits, interest, and capital gains, to which most of these taxes apply. These profits, interest, and capital gains are the result of nothing but the fact that inflation makes more money available at the time when one comes to sell one's products or assets than was available at the time when one bought the means of producing one's products or the assets one now sells. In other words, profits, interest, and capital gains are created simply by virtue of the fact that there is more money in existence later on than there was earlier, and hence larger revenues or proceeds compared with previous outlays. These purely monetary gains are utterly illusory from the point of view of real wealth. They are necessary to replace assets at higher prices. Their taxation takes away funds required for replacement. For elaboration and concrete examples, see the Government Against the Economy. On the basis of this discussion, it should be clear that if we want to return to economic progress in the United States, we have got to start phasing out the inheritance tax, the progressive personal income tax, the corporate income tax, the capital gains tax, and the Social Security system. And of course, we have to move toward a gold standard and the end of arbitrary money creation. This program requires major reductions in government spending. Cutting the taxes without cutting government spending is no solution, for then the government either has to borrow what it previously obtained in taxes or print it. If it borrows it, it draws even more capital out of the economic system than the tax reductions add. For every dollar it borrows is a dollar less available in the form of private capital. On the other hand, a dollar by which it reduces taxes could add a dollar of private capital only if it were 100% saved, which is unlikely even in the case of the inheritance tax. If the government prints the money it previously received in taxes, it undermines saving and capital accumulation in all the ways associated with inflation, including the artificial creation of profits, interest, and capital gains that are subjected to taxation as genuine income, as I have just explained. Thus, the tax cuts must be accompanied by government spending cuts, that is, by balanced budgets or even budget surpluses. The cut in government spending could begin with a total abolition of such government departments as education, energy, and housing and urban development, and sharp cutbacks in all other civilian programs. The Social Security retirement age, for example, could be raised 3, 4, or 6 months for every passing year until the system ceased to exist. Steadily increasing fees could be charged in connection with programs like Medicare and Medicaid until they ceased to exist. The defense budget, too, could be substantially cut after the United States stopped subsidies to the Soviet Union and its allies, whether in the form of government-guaranteed loans, outright gifts, or pressure on lenders. If we allowed the socialist countries to suffer the economic consequences of their system, they would cease to be a military threat to us, and we could then safely reduce our defense budget. What is critical is to immediately achieve sufficient reductions in government spending and taxes so that the economic system can once again begin to progress. If this is accomplished, any given level of government activity will grow less and less burdensome because it will represent a smaller and smaller share of a larger and larger economy, and the economy could progress the more rapidly as further cuts in government activity were achieved in years to come. Spending, tax, and regulatory cuts would increase not just the incentive and means to save, but all of the incentives to produce and compete. People would work harder and produce more in the knowledge that more of what they earned was theirs to keep. More new companies would be started and be able to grow rapidly and challenge the established firms if they could plow back most of their profits and were relatively free of regulation. Thus, the rate of innovation and technological progress would increase, along with a rise in the proportion of output devoted to capital goods. This is clearly the path to the long-term economic recovery of the United States or any other country. This, of course, is not how tax reform is usually perceived. The usual view is that the kind of tax cuts I have outlined as most necessary would be of benefit only to the rich and the corporations, an opinion based on ignorance of all that we have discussed concerning the general benefits from private property and the causes of economic progress. I would now like to turn to a discussion of private ownership of land and natural resources. As I have observed, this is an aspect of the institution of private property that has been condemned by many economists, who in other respects were supporters of capitalism, notably James Mill, Henry George, and Philip Wicksteed. I will begin by presenting the most serious case that is made against private ownership of land and natural resources. This case rests on what is known as the Ricardian theory of land rent. To begin to understand it, we must realize that Ricardo lived in late 18th and early 19th century England. It was a common practice in his day for farmers to rent the land they worked from aristocratic landowners. Ricardo focused on the portion of such rents that were paid not as compensation for the cost of the buildings or any kind of improvements that had been made upon the land, but, as he put it, for the use of the original and indestructible powers of the land itself. This abstract portion of the rents actually paid and received, Ricardo held to exist, even when the land was farmed by its owner. In that case, he held, some part of the value of the produce is attributable not as compensation for any cost incurred, nor as a rate of profit on capital invested, but as a payment for the so-called original and indestructible powers of the land. Ricardo explained the origin and determination of land rent in the following way. I paraphrase his discussion. In a country with an abundance of land of the first or best quality, and that is thinly populated, land will yield no rent. In such conditions, people can obtain the best land merely by appropriating it from nature. They are therefore not under the necessity of paying anything for its use. They will pay for the use of buildings or improvements made upon the land, but nothing for the use of the land considered by itself. Land rent commences, says Ricardo, when the population of the country grows to the point where all land of the first quality has been brought under cultivation, and it becomes necessary to resort to land of the second quality. On land of the second quality, the same quantity of labor and capital produces less than on land of the first quality. It produces less because the soil is simply inferior, or because part of the labor and capital must be expended in transporting the produce a greater distance to market, or in first making improvements that land of the better quality already possesses naturally. The rent that will be paid depends on the difference in the productivity of labor and capital on the two grades of land. If, for example, the same labor and capital produces 100 units of product, or $100 of product value on land of the first quality, and only 90 units of product, or $90 of product value on land of the second quality, then people will be willing to pay a rent of $10 or $10 for the right to produce on land of the first quality. They will be willing to pay $10 for the use of first quality land, because their labor and capital produces 10 more on that land than on land of the second quality, which is their next best alternative. If they can rent land of the first quality for just the smallest amount under 10, they have a special gain in renting it, and thus their competition will drive its rent to 10. At that point, the product or income obtained by labor and capital becomes no greater on land of the first quality than it is on land of the second quality. Rent absorbs the difference. Now, if the population of the country grows further, to the point where all the land of the second quality has been brought under cultivation, and resort must be had to land of the third quality, then, says Ricardo, rent will commence on land of the second quality and will increase on land of the first quality. For example, if the same labor and capital that produces 100 on land of the first quality and 90 on land of the second quality produces 80 on land of the third quality, then when it becomes necessary to resort to land of the third quality, land of the second quality will begin to yield a rent of 10, while the rent on land of the first quality will rise to 20. This land rent theory is intimately bound up with Ricardo's and the other classical economists' ideas on diminishing returns and population growth. The law of diminishing returns, as they propounded it, held that successive equal doses of labor and capital, when applied to a given piece of land, yield smaller and smaller increments of product. In effect, a second dose of labor and capital applied to land of the first quality is comparable in its results to the first dose applied on land of the second quality, and so on. Their views on population enter in explaining the limits that exist to the formation of land rent at any given time. According to Malthus, whose views on population Ricardo largely accepted, population tends to grow up to the limits of the food supply. Taken in conjunction with the rent theory, that means that population tends to grow until the land that must be cultivated is of such an inferior degree of fertility that it yields barely enough to enable its cultivators to survive and rear the number of children required to replace them. All output in excess of what is required for subsistence then shows up as land rent. If, for example, we assume that 70 units of product represents subsistence, and that it is the product of the same amount of labor and capital we have been considering, but when applied to land of the fourth quality, then in our hypothetical country, a rent of 10 would be reached on land of the third quality, 20 on land of the second quality, and 30 on land of the first quality. This would represent a kind of equilibrium. Rent could not grow further because population could not grow further. An additional population could not be sustained, since yields would be too low to support it. Now, what would happen if some improvements in production were made? Improvements that would increase the output of labor and capital on all the different grades of land. For example, suppose that with the use of the same labor and capital, first quality land could now yield 110 units of product, second quality land 100 units of product, third quality land 90 units of product, and fourth quality land 80 units of product. For a time, everyone would be better off. But then, precisely as a result of their greater prosperity, more children would survive to adulthood, population would grow, more land would need to be cultivated, and it would become necessary to resort to land of the fifth quality. The great mass of people who lived by their labor would end up no better off than they had been before. From their point of view, the long-run effect of the improvements would simply be that a larger number of them survived at the edge of subsistence. Land of the fifth quality, which before could not be cultivated because it yielded less than subsistence, would now yield subsistence and would be cultivated. Rent would commence on land of the fourth quality, which previously yielded no rent, and would increase on all the higher grades of land. Thus, the increase in yields on all the different grades of land previously cultivated would end up in the pockets of the landowners as additional rent, while the great mass of people toiled on at subsistence. It was on the basis of this analysis that Ricardo and many other classical economists concluded that the natural or equilibrium level of wages is subsistence, and that rent tends to constitute a larger and larger proportion of national income as a country grows in wealth and population. To be fully just, I should point out that Ricardo sometimes admitted that in an improving country, wages might stay ahead of their so-called natural level for an indefinite period of time, and by a wider and wider margin. But he could not free himself from thinking of subsistence as representing an equilibrium. Ricardo's views are understandable if one keeps in mind when he lived, and that his knowledge of history referred to the centuries prior to the Industrial Revolution. The 500 years from 1250 to 1750 strongly appear to confirm his view that economic improvements benefit primarily the landowners, while leaving the position of the mass of people unchanged. Those 500 years represented a period of significant improvement when considered from beginning to end. Yet the standard of living of most people was hardly touched. The major beneficiaries by far were the landowning aristocracy and those merchants and artisans who enjoyed their patronage. The landowning aristocrats could afford magnificent homes, fine furniture, clothing, and coaches. But the mass of people still could not afford new clothing, meat, or often even enough bread to still their hunger. While Ricardo himself did not advocate the nationalization of land or the confiscatory taxation of land rent, others did. His theory led people to view landowners as receiving the greatest incomes in the society and doing the least to earn them, as passively sitting back and pocketing the fruits of progress and other people's labor by virtue merely of the growth of population. It should not be surprising that they soon demanded that these unearned gains be used for the good of all. These views on land and land rent exert an important, if not generally recognized, influence on public opinion in the present-day United States. They provide much of the intellectual basis for proposals to nationalize the American oil industry and for the so-called windfall profits tax that was enacted when price controls on domestic crude oil were removed. The rise in the world price of crude oil is widely seen as the result of a growth both in world population and in average oil usage per capita, pressing upon limited reserves of oil. The owners of the reserves are perceived as undeserving beneficiaries of this process. The objective of the nationalization proposals and of the windfall profits tax is to seize these allegedly undeserved gains and use them for the general welfare. These views on land and land rent play a major role in perpetuating the United States government's enormous land holdings in the western states and in Alaska. In many of the western states, the federal government owns over half the land. In Alaska, it owns about 99%. It is thought that in government hands, the land serves everyone, while in private hands, it would merely provide unearned income to its owners. These views also influence public opinion in its appraisal of conditions in other countries. It is taken for granted that a precondition of overcoming poverty in many of the backward countries is land reform, by which is meant the confiscation and redistribution of all significant size land holdings. The economic intent of these proposals is to give small cultivators the allegedly unearned rents now going to the large landowners. The communists and socialists, I should point out, are more consistent than the advocates of land reform. They hold that land reform would merely transfer land rents to a larger number of people than had received them before, and would leave basic conditions unaltered. Those cultivators to whom the better grades of land were given would earn more for the same labor than those to whom the poorer grades were given, and those working the poorest grades of land would receive no benefit at all. Nor would the dwellers of towns and cities receive any benefit. The communists and the socialists, therefore, advocate the nationalization of the land rather than its redistribution, and the use of the land rents for the alleged benefit of the whole society. Now, what is wrong with Ricardo's theory of land rent and his conclusion that landowners passively sit back and pocket the fruits of progress and other people's labor? We can begin to find the answer if we look again at the case of economic progress and a rise in yields on all grades of land. Only this time, let us consider a far more rapid rate of economic progress than before. Instead of assuming that over a generation or two, the yield on land of the first quality rises from 100 to 110, on land of the second quality from 90 to 100, and on all others by an increment of 10, let us assume that in a single generation, the yields on all grades of land are doubled or tripled when the same amount of labor is applied to them, and that ways are found to transform previously submarginal land into land of relatively high quality. Under these conditions, even if the population were to double in a single generation, an enormous rate of increase not experienced in the United States since colonial times, there would be no tendency toward a rise in the economic significance of land rent, that is, no tendency toward a rise in the share of so-called national income constituted by land rent. On the contrary, under these conditions, the share of national income constituted by land rent would actually tend to fall. With a doubled population, and thus a doubled number of people available to provide labor for agriculture, either in the form of direct labor on the land, or in the form of producing improved tools, implements, and other aids to agriculture, when double the labor was applied to them. This is consistent with their doubling when the same amount of labor is applied to them, and with allowing for diminishing returns when double the labor is applied to them. Thus, if we began in conditions in which it was necessary to cultivate land of the fourth quality with a yield of 70, and now population has doubled and yields per acre have almost quadrupled or sextupled, it could well be the case that land of the fourth quality would be thrown out of cultivation. It certainly would be if the doubled population did not want almost quadruple or sextuple the quantity of food or other agricultural products. Even if it did want quadruple or sextuple the quantity of food and other agricultural products, the ability to make land that was previously of the fifth, sixth, or seventh quality into the land of the first, second, or third quality would operate to throw land of the fourth quality out of cultivation. The effect would obviously be to reduce land rent taken as a proportion of the value of agricultural output. Initially, the total output of one unit each of the four grades of land was 100 plus 90 plus 80 plus 70, that is 340. Rent was 30 plus 20 plus 10, that is 60. Rent was thus 60 over 340, or almost 18%, measured in terms of the agricultural output. Now the total product of three grades of land is perhaps 380 plus 340 plus 300, or 1020, and rent is now 80 plus 40. The difference between output on the first and third quality land, not the fourth any longer, and between output on the second and third quality land. The third quality land itself no longer yields rent. Rent as a share of agricultural produce is now only 120 over 1020, or about 12%, considerably less than before. In terms of national income and the overall production of the whole economy, the relative decline in rent would be still greater, because the conditions of the case imply a decline in the size of agriculture relative to the rest of the economic system. They imply a decline in the proportion of the population employed in agriculture. Now, this is far more than a hypothetical example. In essence, it describes actual facts of the economic history of the Western world since the Industrial Revolution. Starting about 1750, the rate of economic progress in Britain and British North America began to accelerate, and by the early 19th century was far outstripping increases in population and the consequent operation of the law of diminishing returns and the need to resort to inferior degrees of land. In the course of the 19th century, similar developments occurred in various countries on the European continent. A succession of radical improvements continuing right down to the present time has enormously increased the productivity of labor and the yields per acre on all grades of agricultural land. The poorest land commercially cultivated in the Western world today is vastly more productive than the very best land in use 30 or 40 years ago, let alone in Ricardo's day. It is no exaggeration to say that modern technology is able to make mountains and deserts into land that is far more productive than the very best lands cultivated not many decades ago. Southern California and Israel are outstanding examples. They are examples of previously submarginal land being converted into land of extremely high quality. This same process of converting previously submarginal land into very high quality land was exemplified in a different form by the improvements in ocean and overland transportation that took place throughout the 19th century. Before the days of low-cost ocean transport, practically all of the land of North America had to be considered submarginal from the point of view of Western Europe. Before the days of the railroad, the extremely productive land of the American Midwest had to be considered submarginal from the point of view of the rest of the country and the rest of the world. But with these improvements, this land emerged as an enormous addition to the supply of very best quality land. In the eastern United States, in places like New York, Vermont, and Massachusetts, there are actually substantial tracts of land that at one time were farmed, but have since been put back to forest, because they were displaced by the competition of far superior Midwestern lands. Similar developments occurred in Great Britain in the 19th century. The resulting sharp decline in the relative significance of land rent can be seen if one compares the locus of wealth in Great Britain in 1850 with its locus in 1750. In 1750, the locus of wealth was great landed estates. In 1850, it was far and away industry and commerce. The same course of development I have described with respect to agriculture took place with respect to mining as well. The poorest quality mines in commercial operation at any given time have tended to be far more productive than the very best quality mines in operation a generation or so before. Now, this rapid rate of increase in agricultural and mining productivity has not been a mysterious accident. It is the result, precisely, of the private ownership of land and natural resources. The private ownership of land and natural resources gives each individual owner the incentive to improve his property, to use it for the benefit of the market, and to go on seeking ways to increase its efficiency and yield. Competition among the various private owners leads to the rapid, widespread adoption of whatever improvements are introduced, and requires that anyone wishing to go on earning a high rate of profit introduce still further improvements. In other words, the combination of the incentive to save and accumulate capital, the profit motive, and the freedom of competition that private ownership establishes operates to rapidly and steadily increase the yield of agricultural and mining property, and thus to reduce land rent. Private ownership increases production, and this counteracts diminishing returns and the need to resort to inferior grades of land. In this way, private ownership of land reduces land rent. To say the same thing in a different way, a growing significance of land rent is the reflection of an increasing scarcity of the better grades of land. Private ownership of land, on the other hand, provides the incentives and the means for making each piece of land more productive and bringing into production every piece that is better than what is presently in use. It is thus the most powerful force operating in favor of abundance and against any growing scarcity of the better grades of land. Thus it works to reduce the economic significance of land rent. This principle that private property is what reduces the significance of land rent is confirmed if we examine the historical facts. The beginning of the more rapid rate of progress in agriculture coincides with a vast extension of the institution of private property. In the century and a quarter or so following 1750, practically the whole of the territory of the United States east of the Mississippi River and extending several hundred miles to the west of it became private property. In addition, the second half of the 18th century was the major period of the enclosure movement in Great Britain. This was a movement that established private property in land where before there had been communal property. The enclosure movement converted village-owned pastures and forests into separate private property holdings. It also consolidated into larger, compact units the small, scattered strips of land that many villagers had previously farmed. The result was the large-scale creation of modern private farms in Britain. This was followed by the rise of scientific farming, selective animal breeding, the development of newer and better strains of seed, and the application of more modern tools and implements. Furthermore, both in Britain and on the continent of Europe, the power of feudal laws and customs was broken in other respects as well. Property, which had previously been prohibited from being sold or even leased on a long-term basis, because it was viewed as having to provide support for an unbroken line of future descendants, rather than being the private possession of a living individual, was now allowed to be sold or leased on long term. This made possible the transfer of such property to more efficient hands. Also, the corollary of the abolition of serfdom, which had bound workers to the soil, was that landowners could now fire unnecessary workers. This gave them a powerful incentive to seek more efficient methods of production, which incentive had previously been lacking because of feudalism's violation of the right to fire along with the right to quit. In our own day, the principle that private property reduces land rent is clearly confirmed by the oil situation. As I explained yesterday, the U.S. government's ownership of vast land areas in the western states and in Alaska operates to keep vast amounts of oil off the market. The same is true of its ownership of the continental shelf. If these areas were privately owned or open to the establishment of private ownership, the most profitable use to which they could be put would be to develop them and extract and sell the oil they contained. The effect would be vastly more oil on the market and thus a lower price of oil. The effect of this in turn would be a reduction in the so-called mining rents derived from owning oil deposits and a reduced significance attaching to the ownership of oil deposits. This result would be achieved the more strongly the more the territory throughout the world that was privately owned. For then the greater would be the volume of oil deposits under the control of people who had an incentive to develop them and extract and sell the oil they contained. The result would also be achieved the more strongly the more the property rights of the existing private owners of oil deposits and of all other forms of energy deposits were respected. If, for example, the owners of existing privately owned oil deposits are not forced to operate under price controls, rising taxes, or the threat of confiscation through nationalization or antitrust divestitures, they will invest more and produce more oil. By the same token, if the property rights of the owners of natural gas deposits, coal mines, and uranium mines are not infringed, they will produce more of these forms of energy, which of course compete with oil, and whose more abundant production must keep down the price of oil and any mining rents derived from the ownership of oil deposits. Thus, private property and respect for the rights of its owners is what holds down and actually reduces the significance of land rent. However paradoxical it may seem, the objections and criticisms that Ricardo's followers raised against private ownership of land should have been directed against the absence of private ownership of land and against violations of the rights of existing private owners. For it is the absence of private property and the violation of property rights in land that hold down the supply of agricultural and mineral products and thus bring about a scarcity of the better grades of land and mineral deposits, and so increase the significance of land rent. It is precisely government intervention at home and the worldwide nationalization of oil deposits that have made possible the emergence of a new aristocratic class of officials and sheiks who derive enormous revenues through absolutely no productive contribution on their part. Abolish that intervention and open more land to private ownership, and the rents derived from the ownership of oil deposits will be sharply reduced. Now I want to deal with a further criticism of private ownership of land, one which may even have come to mind in connection with my demonstration of the fact that private ownership would result in more oil being brought to market. This is the so-called conservation doctrine. According to this doctrine, private ownership of land results in a disregard for the interests of the future and in too much attention being paid to the demands of the present. It thus allegedly brings about the too rapid exhaustion of mineral deposits and even the destruction of the productive powers of agricultural land. Deforestation of timberlands and the near extinction of the American buffalo earlier in this century are frequently cited as examples in support of this view. And whenever they admit that private ownership would result in more oil coming on the market, conservationists object that would only worsen the problem of the scarcity of oil in future generations. So let me address the conservation doctrine. The first point to realize is that precisely private ownership is what is required in order to give due weight to the interests of the future. And the deforestation of the timberlands is the best proof of this. The timberlands that were wantonly deforested were timberlands owned by the government. They were deforested by private logging companies that had a property right only in the trees they removed, not in the land from which they took the trees, nor therefore in any new trees that might later grow on that land. Had the logging companies owned the land and thus had a property right in any new trees that could have grown on that land, they would have had an incentive to replant. Replanting would have been profitable as soon as the prospective price of mature trees was judged likely to exceed the cost of replanting by enough to afford the going rate of profit on the capital that would have had to be invested, compounded for the period in question. For example, if it cost 10 cents to plant a new tree that would mature 40 years later, and the going rate of profit on capital were 10% a year, it would have been profitable to replant as soon as the prospective price of a new tree were judged likely to be $3.20 or more. I arrive at this price because at 10% per year, a sum doubles in approximately 8 years. Over 40 years, the cost of planting would have had to double 5 times in the price to make the operation yield the 10% annual return compounded. 5 doublings represent an increase of 32 times. Because the logging companies did not own the land, they had no incentive to incur the cost of replanting, no matter how high the prospective price of mature trees was judged to be. Because while they would have incurred the cost of replanting, they would have had no claim to the benefit. The price of any mature trees they would have planted would have belonged to whomever the government chose to allow to harvest the tree crop 40 years later. Under such conditions, farmers would not replant next year's wheat crop, not if they were merely to incur the cost, while someone else would reap the benefit. The obvious solution to the problem of deforestation is to make forest land into private property. When it is private property, trees are planted commercially as a long-term crop. Such commercial planting is a common practice in Western Europe and in such eastern states as Vermont. Turning now to the American buffalo for a moment. They were driven to virtual extinction not because of any wastes inherent in private ownership of the land, but because of its inherent efficiency. To understand this point, all we need do is realize that buffalo could have been gathered onto ranches and raised in much the same way as cattle are raised. This was an obvious physical possibility. We must ask why it was not done. The answer is simple. The consumers of buffalo meat and buffalo hides were unwilling to pay prices for buffalo meat and buffalo hides that would cover the costs of raising those animals and provide the going rate of profit on the capital invested. The consumers were, however, willing to pay such prices for beef and cow hides and pork and pig skins. The simple fact is that buffalo were driven to virtual extinction because they could not stand the competition of cattle and hogs. Cattle and hogs offered more to the buying public in terms of quality of product and cost of production than did the buffalo. It would have been the height of inefficiency to force people to accept products they liked less, or at a higher cost, or both, merely in order to preserve the buffalo in large numbers. And the further effect would have been that while more buffalo might have lived, fewer cattle and hogs would have lived. Why cattle and hogs, and far more importantly the interests of man, should be sacrificed for the sake of the buffalo, and why that should be called an improvement in efficiency, is a question that the conservationists should attempt to answer if they think they can. Now, this does not mean that people ought not to have any interest in preserving specimens of the various species, such as buffalo. It would undoubtedly be of some value if a pair of dinosaurs could be found somewhere and made to breed. Such a limited objective could easily be achieved if some of the people who claim to be so concerned about the various species contributed some money for the purchase of land and the operation of special preserves for the so-called endangered species. The right to private property and land includes the right of people to use their property for this purpose too, if they wish. Thus, there is simply no legitimate basis for anyone raising the issue of species extinction as a criticism of the institution of private property. It is an institution vital to the multiplication of the human species, the only species that ultimately matters. As for the issue of the too rapid depletion of mineral deposits, I must repeat a few of the points I made in this connection in The Government Against the Economy. The most fundamental fact about natural resources is that the entire world, indeed the entire universe, is made of nothing but natural resources. Every inch of the world is made of nothing but chemical elements, that is, natural resources. The whole world is just so much iron, copper, nitrogen, hydrogen, etc. Each of these, including gold, silver, and platinum, exists in a quantity enormously in excess of any that has ever been mined. And energy in the world is no less abundant than matter. It is all around us, in sunlight, thunderstorms, the wind and tides, and the nuclei and electrons of atoms, as well as in deposits of fossil fuels. For all practical purposes, in nature, the supply of energy and matter and each of the specific chemical elements is infinite. These supplies are nothing less than a measure of the universe. What is relevant for the economic activity of man is not the virtually infinite supplies of natural resources that exist in nature, but the fraction of them that is economically usable by man. That is, the fraction of them about which man possesses the necessary knowledge and over which he has the necessary physical power to direct them to the achievement of his purposes, and to do so without having to use an inordinate amount of labor. This supply of natural resources, the economically usable supply, is expandable. It expands in direct proportion as man expands his knowledge of and physical power over the world and the universe. For example, wood, coal, oil, and uranium became economically usable natural resources when and as man discovered their uses and acquired the means of gaining access to them and directing them to the satisfaction of his wants without having to expend an inordinate amount of labor to do so. The invention and production of such things as dynamite, steam shovels, improved drilling equipment, of anything that increases man's power to move masses of matter or separate one kind from another, serves to increase the supply of economically usable natural resources. While the supplies of such things as iron, copper, and energy in the world may be regarded as constants, the fraction of these supplies that man is able to use for the achievement of his purposes has grown sharply in every generation since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Man has increased the supply of economically usable natural resources right along with his ability to produce products from them. Such resources have, in fact, been created far more rapidly than the previously existing supplies have been depleted. And now, too, we are in a position in which the economically usable supply of energy might well be increased far beyond all previous measure. All that would be required, for example, would be a breakthrough making possible the extraction of oil from shale with an amount of labor no greater than is required to obtain it from liquid deposits today. The same result would occur if we could learn to produce gasoline from coal with a sufficient reduction in the quantity of labor now required. Or if we could develop a commercially viable process of hydrogen fusion. To achieve such results, the essential precondition is private ownership of land and natural resources. This, together with a society's commitment to reason and science, virtually guarantees that as time passes, man's knowledge of and power over the physical world will increase. In such an environment, science and technology will provide the knowledge and the methods, and the incentives of private ownership will both guarantee their application and powerfully stimulate their development in the first place. In this way, the institution of private property in land and natural resources serves steadily to increase the supplies of natural resources coming to the market. Thus, it is not at all the case that private ownership would provide us with a merely temporary increase in the supply of oil, but with a permanent and ever-growing increase in the supply of economically usable energy. More liquid oil today and in the coming generation, still more energy, derived from shale oil perhaps, in the generation or two thereafter, and yet even greater supplies of economically usable energy in possibly very different forms further in the future. Private ownership of land and natural resources thus operates to permanently hold down the significance of so-called mining rents. To summarize this lecture, I began by showing how the institution of inheritance promotes saving and capital accumulation and thus operates to the interest of everyone, non-heirs as well as heirs. I showed why the relative significance of any given inherited fortune tends to decline as time passes, in that it tends to earn a relatively low rate of return, unless the heirs possess special talents for investing, and to be repeatedly subdivided among more and more heirs. I explained how inheritance taxes reduce capital accumulation, and thus the rate of economic progress, and why the progressive personal income tax, the corporate income tax, and the capital gains tax all have similar effects. I explained how the Social Security system, inflation, and government deficits also produce the same effect. I pointed out that the phasing out of these taxes, together with the establishment of a gold standard and a radical reduction in government spending, are vital steps in achieving a resumption of economic progress. I then presented an account of Ricardo's theory of land rent and how it underlies the special hostility that exists toward private ownership of land and natural resources. I showed how precisely private ownership of land is what is required to prevent the results Ricardo and his followers feared, and that the existence of such results in the centuries preceding the Industrial Revolution was the effect of the absence of private property in land and of major violations of the rights of property owners. Finally, I offered a rebuttal of the claims of the conservationists that private property causes deforestation, the extermination of species, and the too rapid depletion of mineral deposits. In my next lecture, I will begin with a critique of the doctrine that the institution of private property is tainted insofar as existing property holdings can be traced back to a point of violent expropriation of previous property owners in earlier centuries. I will deal with a related matter of demands for land reform. I will then apply what we have learned of the general benefit derived from the existence of privately owned means of production in a division of labor society to the question of the limits of the territorial sovereignty of countries. In connection with this last discussion, I will refute various fallacies concerning the allegedly exploitative effects of foreign investment. Finally, I will begin to explain how the existence of a division of labor society exerts a profound influence on the operation of the institution of economic inequality. Thank you.